You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Welcome, everybody, and welcome back if you're rejoining us. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. My next guest, I do not generally credential people because we have them on the show because they know lots of stuff. But this gentleman's resume is so freaking amazing. I'm going to share just a little wee bit of it with you. I'm going to call him a modern day Renaissance man. He was educated at the HBCU that you all know, Morehouse College, as well as the University of Oxford, where he earned not one, but two master's degrees as a Rhodes Scholar. He's also a fiction writer. His debut novel, A Particular Kind of Black Man, was published by Simon & Schuster, you know, that publishing house that nobody's heard of. So I'm sure he's terrible at that. So terrible that Georgetown University has him teach creative writing to their students. It is a deep honor and privilege to have the executive director of the Institute for Policy Studies with me this afternoon to talk about Good Trouble and an incredible conference that the IPS is convening in celebration of John Lewis's legacy on Thursday. What day is today? Tuesday. In 2 days, on the 17th. His name is Tope Fullerin. Welcome to the Maggie Dawn Show, Tope. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me and for that incredible introduction. I feel really honored, so thank you.
Really, my pleasure. Talk about what Good Trouble is. Why is Thursday so important? Why are we seeing rallies and marches all across the country in celebration of John Lewis's legacy and the importance of his legacy in this moment?
Yeah, it's incredibly important. I think John Lewis embodied so much for so many people. And I think the thing that people appreciated most about him was the fact that he brought a sense of morality to the work that he did. He said that there's a proper way that we should act and that we should sort of marshal public policy and all the tools that we have at our disposal to ensure that people have what they need. He spoke about these things in moral terms, and especially in light of that recent horrific bill that passed, that is, in my view, it's an incredibly moral document. I think his words and example resonates in all kinds of ways because he's inviting us to remember who we are and why we are the way we are and who we ought to be helping. And so we want to kind of remind people of those principles, and he embodied that better than perhaps anyone else.
Budgets are moral documents. How we spend our money as a country is a reflection of our values. And just to take one tiny exemplar of what you just said, Tope, and what John Lewis, I think, would have quite a lot to say about, we have just lost two organizations in northern Wisconsin that help homeless or unhoused veterans. And I read a statistic that said if we took the entirety of the new ICE budget, which is now the single largest budget line item in the federal government, that amount of money would be able to house every single unhoused veteran for their lifetimes times three. So again, just taking budgets and how we spend our money as an expression of what we believe in moral terms and how we are either helping or failing regular folks is such an important moment. The Institute, go ahead, Tope, I'm sorry.
I was going to say very quickly that it's a really good point. And I think there's something about what you just said, you know, those two places closing down, that's intrinsically unpatriotic, right? Like, it's not patriotic. And I think a lot of times, I spend a lot of time thinking about patriotism. My parents are from Nigeria. They came to this country. My father in particular was obsessed with what it meant to be an American. And he spent a lot of time like reading books about America, studying, you know, the founding documents and that sort of thing. There was a time in my family's life when we went through a difficult moment and we had to get help from the government in terms of food stamps and other kinds of benefits. And it's not, we didn't get that help because we were bad people or because we were lazy or whatever the analysis is. We got that help because we needed it. And the great thing about this country was that there was somebody in Maine who had absolutely no idea about who we were or what our aspirations were, but they knew they were paying their tax dollars into a system that would help people like me and my family get through a rough patch. And that for me is what America should be all about, is this notion that if somebody is struggling and you have a little bit extra, because we're a community of folks, because we're a country that believes that if one of us is not doing well, then all of us are suffering in a certain way. That's a moral message that people like John Lewis and Martin Luther King talked about extensively in their speeches and in their writing as well, that if you're not providing for folks, that all of us suffer. And so a lot of what we'll be talking about during the symposium as well is like what patriotism means in the 21st century and what it means, especially at a moment when democracy is under assault, when a lot of people feel as if the government is not truly representing them and their moral concerns as well.
Let's stay with this idea, Tope. And folks, if you're just joining me, I've got the executive director for the Institute of Policy Studies, Tope Valerin, with me. The idea that government's job is to ensure overall public health, safety, and wellness.
Yeah.
What I think we've observed in the era of MAGA is differentiation amongst suffering, amongst pain. And the reality is that middle-class folks and folks that maybe one medical bill or one car problem or one other, some emergency away from food insecurity, housing insecurity, one paycheck interrupted, that is different pain depending on identity characteristics has been exploited on sort of this mass scale. When the reality is the pain that is being experienced, and I think very real existential fear for a lot of people, if that's economic insecurity, if that's being convinced that they are unsafe in their day-to-day lives, whether that's real or perceived, that pain, that fear, that suffering is not a differentiable thing from person to person. That human suffering, this existential anxiety, is a shared experience. How do we get back to the place where we can see suffering in others and understand that alleviating that, again, as you said, helps bring us all up? How do we move past these artificial separations or gradations, right? This person's pain and suffering is more important than this other individual's.
So well said, Maggie. And I think that one thing that we have to remember is that we're all neighbors. That is the core part of this. We're all neighbors. We're all Americans. I mentioned before that I grew up in Utah. I grew up in two red states. I grew up in Utah, spent the first 13 years of my life there, and then I moved to Texas. And I can say that in both places, my family and I, we were the minority, and there weren't many people around who were like us, but those communities took care of us. And why was that the case? Well, they saw that my dad was working hard. They saw that my siblings and I, that we were good kids, that we were being raised well, that we cared about our neighborhood, we cared about our community. And when we were going through rough patches, there were times when, you know, our neighbor would say, hey, you know, let me take you to the library and let you, you know, help you to kind of rent some books, or take you to the bookstore so we can buy some books. Let me take you to the museum. These are people who voted differently than my parents did. But they believed in this idea that we were part of the same experiment. We're all Americans and they're struggling. We're going to help them out. And I think that for whatever reason, part of what's happened in this political moment is what you described so beautifully. There are some people who say that we are more American than everyone else, or perhaps that we're separate and these other people don't believe what we believe, so they shouldn't have access to all the riches and everything else that's great about this country. And you see, like, on a kind of smaller level, when, sort of ICE enters some neighborhood and they take away some member of the community who's doing really good work and everybody knows was a really foundational part of that community, people get upset. Why? Because they know that person and they know this person has contributed a great deal and is doing important things in their community, is making their community better. And I think that part of what we're trying to do at IPS is to remind people of the fact that we're all neighbors, that we're all in this together. And that's a real thing, that it's okay to have individual sort of disagreements about policy. Yep. It's okay to have disagreements about a range of things, but we have to step back and ask the question, what does it mean to be an American? And what responsibilities accompany that? What obligations accompany that label that's so important to so many of us?
A follow-up question. And I think this is, we're talking about some of the big questions of the political moment, right?
Yeah.
And that is, how do we translate or show people those connections on a more local level. And I'm going to be really specific here. You mentioned Utah, you mentioned Texas. In the state of Wisconsin and in the Milwaukee metropolitan area, we tend to live in bubbles.
Yeah.
And we now have the day-to-day information consumption bubble, which is confirmation bias. I say to people, don't call them algorithms. Call them confirmation bias affirming machines, right? Like that's what it's designed to do, is feed you the information that you want. How do we help people see those connections with people that they disagree with on a more localized basis? We hear lots of national leaders talking about the problems and what to do about it. We hear punditry, but trying to make it granular and something that can be seen and felt and touched, a person that you know, how do we do that? How do we bring real people's stories to folks?
I think that's such an important question. I think there are probably two responses to this. I think one is crafting public policy that's actually more responsive to where people are and what they need. I think that's an incredibly important component of this. And that's something we'll be talking about during the symposium as well. We'll have panels on ending inequality, on updating our agenda for a just green transition, on laying out a new role for the US in the world, on, of course, the importance of expanding and reimagining democracy. What does democracy mean right now? I think sort of having public policy that actually that's crafted to account for what people need and want, I think is incredibly important. The second thing I'd say is the importance of third spaces. You know, to your point, we spend a lot of time online, sort of ingesting social media, doing all kinds of things. There's something to be said, Maggie, for kind of leaving your home, going to the rec center or the Union Hall or wherever, and just hanging with folks, right? I did a lot of that when I was growing up, and it was incredible. I remember growing up, going to the rec center. There was this older white gentleman. I think he was in his 50s. Everybody was terrified of him because he was a menace on the basketball court. He would beat us, and then he'd sort of give us life lessons on the side. He'd say, you know, well, I run this insurance company, and here's how I do my work. And he'd say, you should come by the job at some point. So, I mean, having an opportunity to kind of step out of this kind of confirmation bias bubble and actually interact with real humans, IRL, as folks say, in real life, is incredibly important. And I think doing more of that will kind of remind us of the fact that we're all connected and in all kinds of important ways.
And I'll just add this, Tope, I think that's incredibly important. When we get out into our communities, do not be afraid to try to engage the tough conversations, as well as having light conversations about the stuff that's completely apolitical that connects us, right? Whatever that may be, sharp elbows on a basketball court with a mean box out as a six-footer. Exactly. I've done a bunch of that. And where did the hook shot go? Why don't people use that anymore?
Maggie, I think it's going to come back. I believe it's such a weapon.
Tope and I are bringing back the hook shot. Folks, keep it locked. We're going to talk about how to bring all politics back into our local communities and the symposium that's happening in Washington, D.C., held by the Institute for Policy Studies. We've got its executive director, Tope Falerin, with us. Stay tuned, folks. The discussion continues on the other side.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Welcome back, everybody. Welcome if you're just joining us. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. I've got a very special guest with me today, a modern Renaissance man, if you will. His name is Tope Falerin. He is the executive director of the Institute for Policy Studies, a Rhodes Scholar, a published fiction author. We're talking today because IPS, alongside The Nation, as well as the Henry A. Wallace Global Fund, as well as Public Citizen, are holding a symposium on Thursday. This coincides with movements, with rallies across the country that are generally titled Good Trouble. If you want to find out where a rally is happening near you, go to goodtrouble.org. All of this in honor of the great and late John Lewis. In the last segment, Tope and I were talking about how to have conversations back in our communities that help people find the shared values that I truly believe we do have. I will never abandon that. I think the vast majority of us, and you see this when survey questions or polling questions are created with care, you see so much more agreement than disagreement amongst people from all kinds of different backgrounds and income levels and races. And you had also mentioned this idea that having those discussions and engaging in disagreement and these value-based discussions is patriotic. It's not owned by one party over the other. And I wanted to ask a follow-up question. One is, in part, okay, what's an example? How do we have some of these conversations? But I'd like us to also take a stab at this other pernicious characterization or claim that I see from the far right to morality.
Yeah.
That they are the arbiters of Christianity, of morality, of goodness. And you do hear this a bit from what I'm going to call the righteous left as well. Yeah. It's easy to demonize folks. How do we create some space? How do we have conversations that don't end in, you're a bad person and I'm a good person and you're not a true patriot and I'm the only patriot, and ends in acrimony and distrust? How do we have those conversations one-on-one?
Such an important point. In our last sort of segment, Maggie, you mentioned the fact that a budget is a moral document. And I think that's exactly right. It's an expression of who we are as a people and what we value. And oftentimes it's lawmakers who are coming up with these ideas and implementing them and placing them, you know, sort of into law. And there are a lot of people who might disagree with what they advance. I say this as a person of faith myself, and faith is incredibly important to me. And it's a core part of the way that I see the world and engage with folks as well. And I think there's a long history of faith powering social movements also. I think social movements are undergirded by faith because the basic idea of a social movement is we want to change the way that reality is structured. We want to change the way that the world is working. And there are a lot of people who say this can't happen or it's not possible for a variety of reasons. You have a group of people who say we have faith that we're going to get there. We have faith that we're going to make this seemingly impossible thing happen. And even you have secular people who join these movements and other kinds of people as well, but they're all engaged in an act of faith, sometimes the kind of secular faith, sometimes it's a more religious faith. And I'm intrigued by the possibility of people coming together and having faith. Again, it doesn't have to derive purely from a kind of religious background. It can just be faith in what we want America to be, faith in each other and the kinds of people we are and what we represent and why we are convinced that America is a kind of indispensable place in the world. It is. I mean, I am the product of that belief because my parents came over as immigrants and they believed in this idea of what this place was, not necessarily based on any evidence they had outside of, like, you know, what they were exposed to on television, the rest of it, but this idea that, like, they could enact their dreams in a real way in this country. So I sort of sometimes take offense when people on the right sort of try to take over the faith question, because there are many of us on the left who are people of faith and who do this work because we have faith. And perhaps having conversations about this, like, what do you believe now and where do you want this country to be? My strong suspicion, Maggie, is that a lot of people would agree, you know, where do we want this country to be? We want people to have an opportunity to buy a house, to take care of their kids, to provide for their kids college education and a range of things. I suspect that we're all on the same page. Often it's the means to get there where we kind of disagree. But if we have a conversation and agree that we agree with the ends, we all want these things, then perhaps it's much easier to have that conversation about the means of getting there.
You said something that I have struggled to express in words about why I get on the radio every day. And it's the faith in every single person that is listening, including those that disagree with me.
Absolutely.
The faith and the trust in you that we can continue to re-engage, talk about difficult things, argue about the means, but hopefully always come back to some of these shared values. Tope, what do you say to Wisconsinites and more broadly Americans that say, I've got nothing to say to people who voted for insert candidate here?
I say that we have to talk to each other, that it's essential. There's, as many social scientists have proven, there are people who voted for Obama and then went on to vote for Donald Trump. The question is, why did you make that switch? My strong suspicion is that you saw what, you know, Trump was talking about, what the Democratic Party was talking about. You said, I'm suffering, and this party that is supposed to be representing me is not acknowledging the fact that I'm suffering, so I'm going to go in this different direction. And so what that means is that you have people who took a decision that reflected their values and where they are and where they were when they made that vote. So to kind of say, because you made this vote, I can never have a conversation with you, I don't think is the right path at all. There always has to be room for engagement and to kind of do our best to build a better tomorrow together.
Folks, that's Tope Fallaron. He's the executive director of the Institute for Policy Studies. Keep making good trouble, Tope, and I hope you come back and do the same on this program again. When we come back on the other side, I'm going to have one of those difficult discussions with a listener who had a lot of criticism for what I had to say yesterday. Keep it locked right here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome, everybody. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. My name is Maggie Dawn. One of the great things about talking with each and every one of you every day is, candidly, when you disagree, it's a great thing. It's not necessarily an easy thing, but your feedback, your pushback, your criticism is always welcome. One of the ways that you can provide that, as well as asking me questions for a more fun and light segment that we do on Fridays, is by emailing the show at askmaggie@civicmedia.us. That's askmaggie@civicmedia.us. You can always text in as well. We got a few people who are a little ticked off about our discussion of faith last half hour with Tope Fallaron of the Institute for Policy Studies. Maybe I'll take the question of faith up on its own on another date. But I wanted to deal with some other feedback that I got yesterday from a listener who was very upset. Yesterday, we spent, I would say, a big chunk of the show talking about racial profiling, disappearing people, about the racialized, that's a very nice way to put it, rhetoric that Donald Trump uses, whether it's dog whistling or actual, frankly, pretty horrifying language. And we were talking about it in the context of Donald Trump's border policy. Got a lot of feedback. I'm going to read something verbatim. I'll correct a little bit of the grammar, but I got an email yesterday and someone was very upset with the overall discussion yesterday. So I'm going to read it to you and then I'm going to take up the points in the email. Hello, here is some independent voter feedback, Maggie. Both political parties are corrupt. You appear to want to find some way to justify the Biden-Harris policy to let millions of people into the country in a grossly unmanaged way. Millions improperly vetted or completely not vetted, all knowingly in violation of this country's border law. You seem, Maggie, like many in both parties, like you don't care if they skipped others who are following the law. As long as immigrants provide cheap labor, do you believe in money over proper legal immigration? You seem to ignore Biden-Harris that caused this current mess. Trump may have his issues, but his administration is tasked with fixing this mess. And you seem to think that taxpayers should just pay any expenses of illegal aliens. And not all who have entered are bad, but some are very likely bad. Drugs and traffickers. Do you really think our adversaries like China haven't taken advantage of these things? You do the public a disservice, Maggie. You are abusing the privilege of having the platform you have, guilting good-natured Americans to not oppose illegal entry is unconscionable. First, to whomever wrote the email, thank you, because it provides an opportunity to have more of a discussion. I hope you consider calling me up someday. And I will admit that I am not always the best listener. That sometimes I start crafting my rebuttal in my head without letting someone fully express what they're thinking. But I think so much of what that listener wrote in that email is simply a mischaracterization of what I have shared over and over on this program. Let's start with the statement that both parties are corrupt. I have never stopped talking about the corrupting influence of money in politics. This dates back to 1976, Buckley v. Vallejo, made worse by a conservative-controlled Supreme Court and Citizens United. Over 80% of Americans believe that we should take money out of politics. That is regardless of partisan affiliation. But what I will offer you is that all corruption isn't created equal. And my belief, and I believe the facts bear this out, if you care to investigate them, is that the MAGA movement and Donald Trump in particular are the most corrupt that we have seen in modern American politics by a distance. The next statements were a lot about that I seem to be justifying the Biden-Harris policies about immigration, that I seem to be justifying and that I was that I'm okay with open borders and knowing violations of the law. That is all false. First of all, I think that the narrative of open borders is factually inaccurate. There is a Cato analysis, which is a conservative think tank, which basically says the immigration crisis was not created by Joe Biden. And in fact, on a month-to-month basis and on a trailing 5 months basis, he was deporting more people. He was detaining more people than Donald Trump did in his first administration. In other words, the people came, not because Joe Biden did anything, but because as the economy started to pick back up after COVID-19 and our economy was the hottest in the world, there was incredible demands for labor. People were also fleeing all kinds of persecution. So I've never advocated for, quote, open borders. And it's a lie to say that that's what Joe Biden did. The listener then said that I think that taxpayers should just pay any expenses of illegal aliens. I've never said that. But what I have said is that people who are here undocumented pay billions in taxes and at every level of government. According to a study by the Institute for Taxation and Economic Policy in 2022, people who are undocumented contributed nearly $100 billion in state, local, and federal taxes. Income taxes, property taxes, sales taxes, fees, fines, and forfeitures, all of it. That equates to nearly $9,000 per undocumented person. And all of that is notwithstanding the fact that undocumented persons are locked out of many, many benefits and even tax credit programs, like the earned income tax credit. To be clear, one third of taxes that are paid by immigrants go to fund programs that they are barred from. So they are paying for things like Medicare and Medicaid that they are barred from. Documented and undocumented immigrants, when taken together, according to ITAP and the Tax Policy Center, pay more annually in total taxes than benefits received. And oh, by the way, let's be really clear here. The Trump administration, in reporting today from the Washington Post, has now said to ICE, do not release anyone who is here undocumented on bond pending a hearing. Lock them up. Well, you heard it here first. When you lock people up, taxpayers pay for that. And so guess what Donald Trump just said? Donald Trump just said that taxpayers in this country will pay for food, medical care, housing, and every single thing else that a human being needs, because we're now going to lock up millions and millions of immigrants. By the way, you don't pay taxes when you're locked in a detention facility, which I could generously call a detention facility, but is more akin to a concentration camp. The person said that some may be okay, but some are bad. Immigrants, both documented and undocumented, commit crimes at lower rates than American citizens. So that, I believe that people that break the law and violent criminals should be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. That includes Jeffrey Epstein and every single last billionaire co-conspirator and fellow pedophile of Jeffrey Epstein. Then the person said this, our adversaries are taking advantage of this. Our adversaries will take advantage of a decimated intelligence services, a decimated defense department, a decimated Department of Justice, a decimated and demoralized FBI, State Department. Need I go on? If you're really concerned about our adversaries taking advantage of us, maybe you might want to consider that Donald Trump has thought, and maybe still does, that Vladimir Putin should be believed. Maybe we should also be concerned, if that's a legitimate point, that our Secretary of Defense used an unsecured method of communication that can be hacked by nations like China. And the final point was that what I have said is unconscionable because I am, quote, guilting good-natured Americans to not oppose illegal entry. We have a broken immigration system. We have no pathway to citizenship for people who have been co-workers, caretakers for our family, who have been here for decades, who have raised their children here, who have never committed a crime. We have no way for those people to gain documented status. Why is that? Republicans and Democrats and progressives and conservatives of good faith know that that is a solvable problem. They know that we need thousands more immigration judges. And yet Donald Trump wants to convince us all that we do not share the same desired outcome. Well, dear listener, I think we do have a shared desired outcome. A secure border, a well-functioning immigration system, those that commit violent crimes prosecuted fairly. But fundamentally, as I have said innumerable times on this program, I believe that we can do two difficult things at the same time in this country. I believe that we can hold in our head two objectives that sometimes seem to be at odds. That we can defend the most fundamental principles our Constitution guaranteed, like due process, and ensure our country's safety and security. So if I have spoken unclearly, if I have misspoken, I hope I have clarified those matters. And to bring it back to the news today, the idea that we will hold potentially hundreds of thousands of immigrants who have never committed a crime in this country indefinitely without the right to a hearing or a lawyer, that is unconscionable. When we come back, we're going to turn the page. I'm going to take a breath and we're going to talk a little sports with Mike Clemens. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome back, everybody. And it is a toasty Tuesday afternoon across the state of Wisconsin and certainly here in the studio. I got a great special guest with me. His name's Mike Clemens. He is one of our amazing sports analysis contributors. Mike will help me sound smarter about sports. You all know that I'll talk about it quite a bit.
I don't know, man. I've heard you on this show, and you certainly know your baseball.
I love the baseball.
And all of it. How often do you get to the ballpark? I mean, as busy as you are doing this show now and everything else you got going on, but you sound like somebody goes probably 10, 15 times a year,
I was
right?
going to say, it's usually in the ballpark of 10 to 15 times a year. More if I can, especially when they're winning, Mike.
How exciting are the Brewers right now, man?
It is.
Seven in a row. They pulled off that. And you know the thing about it, too, Maggie, for me is the access still to baseball.
Yes.
Unbelievable. Because, you know, when you're in Green Bay, God bless them, and I get along with all those people.
Yes.
But they bring out Matt LaFleur like it's the White House press briefing, you know? I'm sitting in Dave Roberts' office after all three losses last week.
Oh.
And him, you know, articulate. Very smart manager, took the Dodgers to the World Series, but him trying to figure out how I beat these guys. And I said,
and beat them they did.
Is this one of the most aggressive teams you've seen on the bases? He said, let me tell you, yeah, they don't strike out. They take chances on every base stealing that they can get. That's a young, dangerous, aggressive team that Murph has got going right now. And he's like, also, it's almost like Hard Knocks, you know, it's sort of the behind the scenes thing.
Yes.
Before he let in the media, I could see through the door. I could see him just take his cap off and massage his scalp like, oh, God.
Yeah. The,
we've lost six this, in a row
oh,
now. Yeah.
Oh.
You know,
and then to bring it around.
That.
It's amazing.
And then I also heard him say to one of his assistants, they said, are you going back with the team tonight? No. I got a date to go golfing here. So I'm going to go golf tomorrow. I'll catch up with you guys in San Francisco. So he's going to Erin Hills.
Nice.
Or Whistling Straits or something.
Whistling Straits.
And then down the signature at Mitchell Airport, you know, and take the private jet out to San Francisco and catch up. Because that's the way those boys roll.
Back in the day, it wasn't quite like that. The other thing that I like about baseball's accessibility is, and the Brewers, the personality of the team, I think, is accessible. The youngness of the team is accessible. The price point on tickets, the specials that they run, makes it accessible. Of all of the professional sporting leagues in the United States these days, baseball remains the most affordable and accessible. And the Brewers as sort of the pinnacle of all of that, right? When I go with my dad, we never pay for parking. In true Milwaukeean fashion, we are parking on Blue Mound
High
or
five.
Wisconsin
High Avenue five.
And walking into the
I'm
stadium.
I'm right there with you. I've got a record going, too. Now, I had a lunch meeting at Summerfest a couple of years ago, and I thought, this I can make it here. Well, they towed the car away. So they caught up with me.
Well, now we got the parking app. Michael, let me ask a question. I think the All-Star game and the Home Run Derby have become sort of this touchstone of debate between baseball generations. My dad hates this.
Yeah.
I kind of have a middle-of-the-road perspective on it. To the extent that these things drive engagement in baseball, they provide a national platform for players like the Miz and folks that people that maybe American League fans or don't catch it or don't care when the Brewers are on national TV. I think it provides a great platform for players that are a little bit less known. I think it brings a little bit of engagement, some folks into the baseball fold that may not otherwise be inclined. What are your thoughts?
The Brewers, Freddie Peralta, Trevor McGill, the closer,
McGill? Yep.
And Jacob Mizrowski, 23 years old, 6'7".
Kid.
They just walked up on a red carpet that they've got now. They're
Good.
In tuxedos before Good they go them. Into the clubhouse and change and get ready for tonight's game. In terms of the game for us as fans, it's still probably the best all-star game out of the three sports.
Correct.
I mean, football's got flag football going
on. Yeah,
now.
Right.
I will tell you what this is really about now in 2025.
Yeah.
It's the convention of Major League Baseball sponsors.
Mm.
The Learjets all fly in. And if you're Walmart or, you know, some oil company or whatever, that's their tires, right? Firestone.
Yep.
You get four tickets to the game. You get to go to some of these parties. You get to meet some of these players. That's what's really going on.
Do they get a swag bag, Mike?
Absolutely.
I'm all about a good swag bag.
That's really what it's all about. There happens to be a game going on, but it's a thank you to the sponsors. The rest of the players and managers get a 4 or 5 day break or so.
Yep.
And as you said, and for Trevor McGill, he just got a bonus.
Heck yeah.
In his contract because he reached it reached the All-Star game, so they check off that box with his agents.
I love the fact that the Brewers, responsive to the incredible success of the Miz, and I think also some toughness that he's demonstrated, they're going to have a Miz t-shirt giveaway. I love this. Yeah. They just announced. What great fun for Brewers fans.
And if you don't follow that closely, so this Jacob Mizorowski is a kid that they saw in spring training. He's 23 years old, 6'7", and he's throwing the ball 103 miles an hour. And one of the things that Pat Murphy, the manager, says, anybody can throw the ball because these guys can hit it. You've got to have some stuff on it. Well, by the time they actually put him out on the mound in a Brewers game, he had 3-4 different pitches, the slider, the curve, you know, changing around.
Yeah, that menu of reliable pitches for Mizorowski is what makes him, I think, unique. You have guys that can throw really fast heat. His is even faster still, right? And I'm thinking of, you know, Uribe. He is a great eighth inning guy. They used him a bit in a closing round, had some control issues last season. But one of the things that I like is you got a guy that's throwing some of the fastest pitches in the major leagues, super young, and he's got all kinds of other stuff. This, for a batter in the major leagues, is a major mind bender. They have no idea what's coming at him.
The arsenal, they call it. And, you know, the fact is, though, a lot of the veteran players, like some of the guys from the Phillies, are saying, this kid's only had 5 starts. I've been in the league 5 years, right, and I'm not going. And the answer to that is, in those 5 starts, some of the things he's done hasn't been done since they've been keeping records since 1901. So he might pitch tonight in the 7th inning. Keep your eyes on that for the All-Star game tonight.
I cannot wait. Mike Clemens, sports commentator extraordinaire. You can find him all across the Civic Media Radio Network. You and I are going to do more of this, my friend.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Thanks so much for listening, everybody. Stay cool out there. Remember, I'll stand up for you. I hope you stand up for me. But it's always better when we stand together. Go Brewers!
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.